I'm going to just quickly introduce tonight's speaker because I think she has a lot to tell us and we'll have a lot to ask her. And the question is why we love. Why do we love? I guess, Dr. Fisher, I can't imagine that this is maybe the single most unifying question that so many of us think about and we spend a lot of our life just wondering about in our free time. And Dr. Fisher probably thinks about it in her free time, but also in her professional time as well. And I think you will share my amazement that she's been able to take something as ethereal and as intangible as love and bring it to the biological level and try to understand what is it about us as human beings that allows us to love or to hate or to form bonds and so on. Dr. Fisher is associated, she's an anthropologist at Rutgers University. And she's written two previous books. One is The Anatomy of Love, A Natural History of Mating, Marriage, and Why We Spread. And this was a very important book that was maybe among the first books or so, called The First Sex, The Natural Talents of Women and How They're Changing the World. We have all of these books in the store, but Dr. Fisher is here to tell us personally about her thoughts and her findings. And I'll just turn this over.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I'll just start out by saying that what I've done is I've put 32 people who were madly in love into a functional MRI brain scanner, 17 who were madly in love and their love was accepted, and 15 who were madly in love and they had just been dumped. And that's the kernel of my most recent book, Why We Love. And so I'm going to just start out by telling you what I think love is, and what we did in the machine, and what we learned, and end up with my newest material for my book number 5. Actually, I've written 4 books on why you fall in love with one person rather than another. Actually, psychologists don't really know why you fall in love with one person rather than another, and in fact, there's very little data on that. So that's going to be my book number 5. Anyway. Shakespeare once said, what 'tis to love? I think people have been wondering about this question since they sat around their campfires or lay and watched the stars a million years ago. We all want to know what love is. And anyway, I think that I don't even use the word love. It means too many different things to too many different people. Instead, I divide love into 3 distinctly different brain systems. I think we've evolved 3 distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is the sex drive, the craving for sexual gratification. W.H. Auden called it an intolerable neural itch, and indeed that's what happens. You can feel it for a whole range of partners. You can feel it driving along in your car, associated with nobody at all. It's associated with testosterone in the brain. And it's a basic part of our human reproductive strategy. The second brain system, romantic love, that elation, the craving, the obsessive thinking, you focus your attention on this particular individual. It's known as passionate love, obsessive love, being in love, infatuation. And I think it's a very distinctly different brain system. I'm going to maintain that romantic love is an addiction. A perfectly wonderful addiction when it's going well, perfectly horrible addiction when it's not going well at all. I'll tell you what, I think it's going to be associated with different brain chemicals, certainly dopamine and norepinephrine, natural stimulants in the brain, and probably low levels of serotonin, which gives you that obsessive thinking about this person. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we found in the brain is that when you fall in love, a certain brain region becomes active that is exactly the same brain region that becomes active when you feel the rush of cocaine. So it's like a sort of a 3-year cocaine high and low. The third brain system that I think evolved from mating and reproduction is attachment, that sense of calm and security that you can feel for a long-term partner. Other scientists have looked at some of the brain circuitry of that, and they now think that different chemicals, oxytocin and vasopressin, are involved. So I think that these three brain systems evolved to do different things. I think the sex drive evolved to get you out there looking for a whole range of partners. I think romantic love evolved to enable you to focus your mating energy on just one at a time, thereby conserving mating time and energy. And I think that attachment evolved to enable you to tolerate this person at least long enough to raise a single child together as a team. And these brain systems interact with each other. You know, you can you see a nice guy at the mall or in the gym or at work, and he's just another nice guy. And then you fall in love with him, and suddenly he becomes very sexually exciting to you, too. I mean, just the way he walks, the way he talks, even his automobile in the parking lot. Anything about him can be not only associated with romance, but also with sexuality. And I think this is in part because when you fall in love, it drives up dopamine in the brain, and that indeed drives up testosterone in the brain, and testosterone is the hormone of desire. This is why I think casual sex is not actually so casual, because with any kind of sexual stimulation, you're driving up dopamine in the brain, and it can push you over that threshold into falling in love. But can the reverse be true? Can you copulate with just a friend and then fall in love with them? Not all the time. Almost all liberated Americans have had sex with somebody who they never fell in love with. So these brain systems can operate rather independently of each other. But not always. The reason is, as I just said, with sex drive, any kind of sexual stimulation drives up dopamine in the brain and can push you over that threshold into falling in love. Sex can also trigger this third brain system, attachment, because with orgasm, you're driving up oxytocin and vasopressin, the brain chemicals associated with attachment. And so you can suddenly, you know, have gone casually to bed with somebody and not only fall in love with them, but either or feel a deep sense of attachment to them. So I'm at Rutgers University, and I say to my students, I said, don't copulate with people that you're not in love with, because you might just fall in love with them. In fact, women are a little bit more susceptible than men are, because in seminal fluid is testosterone and estrogen associated with the sex drive, dopamine and norepinephrine associated with romantic love, and indeed also oxytocin and vasopressin. So when a man is injecting that seminal fluid, he's doing a chemical experiment and can actually trigger some of these two other brain systems. So basically, lust, romantic love, and attachment, these three different chemical systems, can operate in all kinds of ways. Actually, I think this is one of the reasons why you begin to feel less romantic love in a long-term relationship, because as you become more and more attached to somebody and the oxytocin and vasopressin are going up, it suppresses these dopamine circuits. This is one of the reasons I think that if you really want to sustain romantic love in a long-term relationship, you've got to go do novel things together. Novelty drives up dopamine in the brain. This is why vacations are so can be so useful, because you're triggering these brain systems for the sex drive and for romantic love. So these brain systems can interact with each other, but they don't always interact with each other. And I think that's even more important and more interesting to me as an anthropologist, because you can feel deep attachment for one person while you feel intense romantic love for somebody else, while you feel the sex drive unrelated to any of them. So we got we built in complications in our human reproductive strategy, and I think this may well be certainly contribute to the problems that we have. As a matter of fact, you can lie in bed at night and swing from deep feelings of attachment for one person to wild feelings of romantic love for somebody else to feeling of the sex drive for even other people. In short, you got a committee meeting going on in your head as you're swinging from one of these feelings to another. So I think that all three brain systems evolved so that to work together, so that we could have sex, fall in love, form a pair bond, and rear our children as a team. And I think they became somewhat distinct from each other so that we could form a pair bond with one person and, what they politely say in my profession, have an EPC or an extra pair copulation, or be adulterous on the side with somebody else. So, in fact, a million years ago, it may even have been adaptive. I'm not recommending it, but to form a pair bond with one person, and then if you also had sex with somebody else, men would end up having more children with this extra partner. Women would get extra resources from this partner for the children they already had. And we selected, I think, in the human animal for what I call a dual reproductive strategy, a tremendous drive to fall in love, form a pair bond, and also a restlessness in long relationships and a tendency to divorce and remarry. So we've got these three different brain systems. And the one I decided I would study is romantic love. I started out by... First, I want to tell you what happens when you fall in love, and then what we did in the brain and what we found. The first thing that happens when you fall in love is a person takes on what I call special meaning. As a truck driver once said to me, he said, the world had a new center, and that center was Marianne. And this person just becomes the very center of your life. George Bernard Shaw actually defined it a little differently. He said, love consists of overestimating the differences between one woman and another. And indeed, that's pretty well what happens. Then you focus your attention on them. You know, everything about them is special. You can list what you don't like about them, but you sweep that aside and then focus on what you do like about them. You feel intense elation when things are going well. That's dopamine. A mood swings into the despair when things are going poorly, real mood swings. An intense amount of energy, you can walk all night and talk till dawn. You crave them, it's an emotional craving, it's a craving for emotional union. I mean, you'd like to go to bed with them, but what you really want them to do is call you up, and send an email, invite you out, start the emotional connection with you. There's a lot of other characteristics associated with intense romantic love. Not only the sex drive goes up, but you become sexually possessive. You know, if you're just casually sleeping with somebody and they sleep with somebody else, you often really don't care. But if you're in love with somebody, you big time care. It's called mate guarding in the animal community. And when you're madly in love, you become very sexually possessive. But I think the most important characteristics of romantic love is this intense motivation to win this person, the craving for emotional union, and the single greatest characteristic that I think is a part of romantic love is obsessively thinking about this person. As a matter of fact, before I put these people in the MRI machine, my first question to them was always, how long have you been in love? Because I wanted them crazy. They got to be crazy because these machines are expensive and it's very time consuming for everybody. My second question was, what percentage of the day and night do you think about your sweetheart? The people who said, well, I go to bed thinking about her, I wake up in the morning thinking about him. When you're in the middle of that full-blown obsession is when we wanted to put you in the machine. My last question to these people was always the same. There's a real emotional and physical dependence. You become extremely dependent on this individual. So the very last question I would ask them was, would you die for him or her? And I would be staggered at how regularly and how rapidly these people said that they would die for the person that they were in love with. So anyway, then I had to make sure that romantic love was universal. I had a friend who had looked in 170 societies, found evidence of romantic love in every one of them. Love songs, love poems, love magic, myths and legends about love, suicides and homicides because of love. or they simply just told the anthropologist that they were in love. So there's no negative evidence anywhere in the world. I've seen the oldest love letter. It's in a museum case in the archaeology museum in Istanbul. It's written on a lump of clay in cuneiform. I don't know what it says, but I think we all know what it says. And it probably says, you know, email me now. I lost my train of thought. I'm trying to do this without my notes. So anyway, I then decided I would create my own questionnaire about romantic love to make sure for myself that this was something you found in every culture, although there was all this evidence. So I created a questionnaire about romantic love, and I gave it to 437 Americans and 402 Japanese. And as it turns out, on over 80% of the questions, there were no differences. There were no differences, real differences between men and women. Men fall in love faster than women do. 3 out of 4 people who kill themselves when a relationship is over is a man, not a woman. But that intense feeling of romantic passion doesn't seem to be different between the sexes. My population over age 45 showed just as much romantic love as those under 25. This is a brain system like the fear system. It can be triggered at any age. In fact, before I put any of these kids into the machine, I put myself in. And as it turns out, my brain showed actually more activity. I was madly in love at the time. Showed more activity than any of these people ages 18 to 26. He dumped me, so I put myself back in the machine. And then I was off the map on that one. You laugh. I also found no difference between the homosexuals and heterosexuals in my population. You know, who you fall in love with is probably a very different brain system from how you feel when you fall in love. And I don't know why, my homosexual population actually had a little bit more of what we call the sweaty palm syndrome, the pounding heart, the stammering, the sweaty palms, etc. And I think it's largely because there's more barriers in a homosexual relationship. It's just my hypothesis. And that can really sustain romantic love. When the person doesn't call, doesn't write, when there's barriers to the relationship, it can last, it can get even stronger. So anyway, I knew the characteristics of romantic love. I had convinced myself that this was universal, that it could be found in anybody of any age. I thought that if I looked, I could find evidence of it in the brain. So I assembled a team, a neuroscientist, Lucy Brown from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and Art Aaron, a social psychologist from SUNY Stony Brook. And I created what was going to happen to you when you were in the machine. And what happens in the machine is you do 3 tasks. You look at a photograph of your sweetheart for 30 seconds, and you look at a neutral photograph for 30 seconds. So that way you've got your control and your and in the same brain. The problem with romantic love is that you can't stop thinking about your sweetheart. So you got to do something between this positive and the neutral. So I came up with it's a standard psychological distraction task. And what we would do is we would cast on the screen a large number, like 8,421. And they would look at that number, and starting with that number in their heads, start counting backwards in increments of 7. I want to tell you, it drives all the blood into a tiny little part of the parietal lobe. And you've cleansed the brain of emotion, just briefly anyway, and you can capture the brain in this neutral state. So that way, you'd look first at your sweetheart, then you'd count back, then you'd look at the neutral, then you'd count back. So it was positive, count back, neutral, count back, positive, count back, neutral. 6 times, collected 12 groups of scans. And then when you put all the positive scans and all of the neutral scans together, and they cancel out what they've got in common, you're left with the brain in love. So I'll just tell you some of the most important things we found, and then the most important thing we found is activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area. And this is a brain region that actually makes dopamine and sprays dopamine to many brain parts. We also found activity in, it's about the size of a medium-sized shrimp on either side of your head. It's called the caudate nucleus. And it receives a lot of dopamine. It's got a lot of dopamine receptors. So both of these brain regions are part of what they call the reward system, the wanting system, the come-go system, the motivation system. When you reach for a piece of chocolate, it's that system that's going on. When you're going to have a drink, when you want to get a raise, when you want something, it's that brain system that becomes active. Not when you like something, not when you're feeling happy, but when you want something. It's basic to the motivation system in the mind. And that led me to understand romantic love from really an entirely different way. I had felt that romantic love was an emotion, or even a series of emotions, but I came to realize that it's a drive, a basic mating drive, a drive, indeed, that's more powerful than the sex drive. In fact, if you were to ask somebody, you know, if you ask somebody to go to bed with you and they say no, thank you, you certainly don't go killing yourself, or killing somebody else, or slipping into a clinical depression, or stalking them either, for that matter. But when you've been dumped, people, a certain number of people all over the world kill themselves, kill somebody else. It can be stronger than the will to live. Certainly then stronger than the will to eat. People live for love, they sing for love, they dance for love, they write about love, they kill for love, and they die for love. It's one of the most powerful, I would even say the most powerful brain system on earth. Because it plays such an important role, it starts the mating process, which is of course from a Darwinian perspective, whether you're gonna win or lose. We also found a lot of other things in the brain. I'm only going to say one other, and then I'm going to go on to rejection because I want to hear from you and actually have a conversation with you. We found a gender difference. Not in that intense craving. I think men and women find that the same. But in something else. Among our male subjects, we found more activity in a brain region associated with the integration of visual stimuli. So what is no? Women spend their lives trying to look good for men. Men support the pornography industry. And for millions of years, men needed to look at a woman to size her up for signs of health and youth and fertility so that he could court a woman who could bear him healthy babies. And we're beginning to find out why men are so visual. In our female subjects, we found more activity in three brain regions near the back of the brain associated with memory recall. And at first I said, memory recall. And then it began to occur to me, oh yeah. For millions of years, a woman couldn't really look at a man and know whether he'd be a good husband or a good father. She had to remember. She had to remember what he promised last Valentine's Day. She had to remember what he said he'd do last Christmas. She had to remember what he said he was gonna do this coming summer. And what do women do? We spend our lives on the telephone recounting to each other what he did and what he didn't do. We're creating a memory trail. I've never met a man who knew as much as I remembered about the relationship. I think it's a bit of a curse, but nevertheless, women remember. And I think for a very clear Darwinian reason. I think I'll go on to rejection in love. Does anybody have a copy of my book? I thought I might read a poem. Could you just hand that up to me for half a second? I never have the opportunity to read this poem. This would be a wonderful time, thanks very much, to read this poem. I wanted to start the book with the most powerful love poem on earth. And I couldn't find a powerful love poem that was happy. Because when you're happy, why bother writing love poems? It's when you're desperate in the middle of the night that you write love poems. That's when the dopamine's high and you're being intensely creative. So I didn't start the book with it. I found a Walt Whitman poem that was pretty good for the opening poem for the whole book. But this is the most powerfully sad poem that I've ever found. I've read poetry in maybe 25 societies because I actually do think that poetry, other anthropologists look at arrowheads or potsherds or whatever they do to understand human behavior. I think that poetry is a wonderful artifact for understanding human behavior. This poem is anonymous. I don't know if it's male or female. I have my opinion of whether it's a man or a woman. It was recounted in 1896 to a missionary in southern Alaska by a Native American Indian, a Kwakiutl, a Native American Indian. So here's the poem with this music going, but nevertheless. Most powerful love poem on earth, I think. Fires run through my body, the pain of loving you. Pain runs through my body with the fires of my love for you. Sickness wanders my body with my love for you. Pain like a boil about to burst with my love for you. Consumed by fire with my love for you. I remember what you said to me. I am thinking of your love for me. I am torn by your love for me. Pain and more pain. Where are you going with my love? I am told you will go from here. I am told you will leave me here. My body is numb with grief. Remember what I said, my love. Goodbye, my love, goodbye. Thanks. I'll hand it later. I don't think there's really, I mean, there's many deep emotional pains. Emily Dickinson once said, parting is all we need to know of hell. Nobody gets out of love alive. I never met anybody. I actually did meet two people who had never been dumped. They were both exceedingly handsome, exceedingly rich, extremely well known, and I thought extremely shallow. And they'll probably get dumped too. They were both in their 40s when I met them. Everybody gets dumped. One of the most powerful experiences on earth. And I wanted to know the full range of romantic love. So I decided I would put more people in the machine who had just been dumped. That was one of the most difficult things I've ever done. Talking to people who've just been dumped is just, it's a nightmare. I put a sign up on the SUNY Stony Brook bulletin board. Have you just been rejected but can't let go? And people would come in and I would talk to them at great length about the rejection. And then I did exactly the same experiment with them. Looking at the sweetheart, counting back, the neutral count back, exactly the same experiment. Told them exactly what was going to happen to them in the machine. I really didn't have a theory for what was going to happen. I know that when you're dumped, you just like the person harder. In fact, I coined a term for that, frustration attraction. And it's because this reward system in the brain, when you don't get what you want, you just wanted more. So this it keeps on cranking up. What a bad deal. You've just been dumped, you like the person more. So I figured I would find in the brain activity associated with romantic love. But then I started putting people in the machine, and the first person I put in was a girl I'll call Barbara. She was the sweetest little girl. She was maybe 21. She'd never been in love before. I'd put her in the machine 10 months earlier. She hopped over to that hospital. She was so ecstatic about this boy. We caught her brain madly in love, and then 10 months later I walked into the lab in SUNY Stony Brook, and sure enough, there was this girl. She was sitting there. I don't think she'd combed her hair in 3 days, face streaming with tears. She looked like she'd lost 15 pounds, and I was so taken aback, I literally had to step away for a while, and then I said to myself, go ask her if she'd go back in the machine. So I did, and She did. And I put her in the machine. We had all the data for her, and she was very happy to do it. She wasn't happy about anything, but she was willing to do it for me. And when she came out of the machine, we get her out on the gurney. We're still in this giant hospital room and everything. And we give them $50 after they come out and a picture of their brain. So anyway, she comes out, she leaps off this gurney, she tears out of the room, leaves the hospital, doesn't collect her money, nothing. I'm floored. And so then I go on with putting somebody else in the machine, and about 20 minutes later, she comes back, and this girl's face is purple. She's so angry. She's so angry at me. And I said, Barbara, let's go talk about this. And so we sit down in this little ante room right in the hospital, and she's purple with anger at me. And as she starts lighting into me about why do I do this experiment and all this stuff, I suddenly realized she's not mad at Helen Fisher. She is furious at this man who's dumped her, and I have triggered this in her brain. And it's now, it's called abandonment rage. And as it turns out, when this brain system, this reward system, does not get what it wants, it triggers the amygdala and triggers rage. It's called hate rage. So I came to think that maybe I would find in the brain activity in circuits associated with hate rage and with romantic love. So I'm going to tell you very briefly what we found, and then I'll quit and hear from you. But anyway, what we ended up finding in the brain was, sure enough, brain region associated with physical pain, not psychological pain, physical pain. So when you're lying on your bed rocking in physical pain, this is part of the rejection response. Also found activity in a brain region associated with the dopamine circuit, showing that indeed you do fall, you remain in love with the person. Found activity in a brain region associated with taking risks, big risks for big gains and big losses. That's not surprising, but the things people will do when they've been dumped are just staggering. Also found activity in part of the lateral orbital frontal cortex in a brain region associated with obsessive thinking. You obsessively think about this person, and also with controlling rage. So I began to think to myself, you know, this is a very bad combination. Intense romantic love, deep physical pain, obsessive thinking, and rage, and the willingness to risk. And I just simply say that no wonder some people stalk or have suicidal rage or homicidal rage. I mean, now, there's more to stalking than just this brain system, because frankly, I think that when you've been dumped, everybody would like to stalk. You'd like to go, where is he? I mean, you'd like to find out where he is. But most of us have impulse control, and we're not so narcissistic that we do this anyway. So long and short is that we haven't found all of the brain systems associated with stalking, for example, but I think we're on our way to understanding crimes of passion around the world. So I want to end with a story and tell you one other thing, but maybe I'll say that thing. I'll tell you the one other thing, and then maybe we can talk about it during as we talk. None of this data about the brain in love, or the rejected brain in love, says a single thing about why you fall in love with one person rather than another. What this is really about is how you feel when you love. So I've written 4 books, and number 5 is going to be why you fall in love with one person rather than another. And what started me in on this was a year and a half ago, Match.com, the internet dating site, they're the biggest in the world. I think they got 15 million people on it. They're in 22 countries. They came to me 2 days before Christmas. I was minding my own business. I thought my business was pretty shut down for a while. I could do my writing. I get a call saying 2 days after Christmas, would I come and meet the CEO of Match.com? Well, I said, fine. And so I went, met these people. There were like 11 of them in New York. At first, I couldn't really understand. I thought that, anyway. Long and short is, during the course of the day, by the end of the day, they asked me if I wanted to design a new dating site for them. And I looked at the CEO and I said, you know, I'm not a personality psychologist. You know, are you sure you got the right person? I studied the brain, you know. And he said, well, he thought he did. So I said, well, I thought I'd think about it and get back to him right in the beginning of January. So I was at home right before New Year's and I was doing the dishes and I said to myself, you know, you got to get a grip on this one here, you know. So I said, okay, go in and sit at your desk and get an empty sheet of paper and write down on that empty sheet of paper what you actually think you might know about why you fall in love with one person rather than another. What do you know about personality? So I sat there with that empty sheet of paper and I saw myself write dopamine. You know about dopamine. And I know that activity in certain parts of the dopamine system are associated with risk-taking, novelty-seeking, optimism, irreverence, flexibility, curiosity, and creativity. There's data on this. So I said, well, if I'm going to work in the real world, I'm going to call this person something. So I decided I would call this person an explorer. So then I took another sheet of paper and I said, well, what else do you know? And I said, well, okay, you know something about serotonin. And so I wrote serotonin on the top and I said, people with certain aspects of the serotonin system are calm, social, popular. They like to follow rules. They like schedules and routines. They tend to be traditional and conservative. They tend to be religious or spiritual. They tend to be conscientious and somewhat judgmental. And they're very good at managing people. So I decided I would call, and they're very, very home and family oriented. So I thought I would just call this person the builder. I'd written a book on gender differences in the brain, so I knew something about estrogen. So I wrote estrogen on my third sheet of paper, and I know that estrogen is associated with imagination, verbal abilities, people skills, sympathy, altruism, creativity, flexibility. They're very good with people, so I decided I would call this person the negotiator. And last but not least, I knew something about testosterone. I called this person the director. They tend to be analytical, logical, rational. We're all rational in our own way, but rational in the traditional way. Decisive, assertive, and I call that person the director. So anyway, I had these four sheets of paper on types of personality. And I went off to the symphony that night with my friend. And on the way home from the symphony, I was walking past Barnes & Noble, and I said, baby, you know, I think I better go and buy some books on personality. So I went and I bought 9 books on personality, and I started reading them. And as it turns out, Plato, Aristotle, Galen, 2nd century, Dr. Paracelsus, 15th century, Viennese doctor, Carl Jung, Myers and Briggs, and several others have all basically talked about 4 personality types, and they corresponded perfectly with my 4 genetic profiles. So my theory is that people of different genetic profiles tend to fall in love with each other for the Darwinian reason that we're drawn to people with a different genetic type so that we can create more variety in our lineage and come to the job of parenting with a different array of parenting skills. So anyway, that's the very basis of this chemistry.com dating site. I can tell you more about it. But anyway, I'm trying to get to the bottom in this next book. And what's nice about it is they've already got 850,000 people on the dating site. So, and they're all going to come back and tell me who they find attractive and who they don't. So I'm going to have probably the biggest data set in the world of who falls in love with whom. So in fact, I'm going to my first wedding next Saturday night. A negotiator man has fallen in love with a director woman, and he met her after Katrina. He lost everything in Katrina. He came up to New Jersey, got onto chemistry.com, met this girl Stacy, second grade teacher, and they fell in love, and they went down during her vacation to someplace in the Bahamas where he leapt up, can you imagine, leapt up on the bandstand and grabbed the mic and asked her to marry him in this resort hotel. So anyway, the wedding is next Saturday and they want me to go. Well, that's fine, I'm happy to do it. And I understand, and they fit my theory that a negotiator and a director are likely to fall for each other. Anyway, I want to finish with a story and then hear from you. The story is apparently a true story. It was told to me third hand, but for all I know, it's 25th hand. It's the story of a young man who, at University SUNY Stony Brook, who knew about our work, and he knew that maybe, we know now that if you do novel things with somebody, you're going to drive up dopamine in the brain and perhaps push somebody over that threshold into falling in love with you. And he was madly, he's a graduate student, and he was madly in love with another graduate student at SUNY Stony Brook. And they were all at a conference in Beijing. And so he decided that what he would do is he would invite this girl to go on a rickshaw ride with him, hoping that as they were careening through the buses and the trucks and the donkeys and the bicycles and everything and swerving to and fro, that all the excitement and the novelty and the danger would drive up the dopamine in the brain and she would fall in love with him. So off they go. And she's having a wonderful time. She's squealing and clinging to him and laughing, having a wonderful time. And he's thinking to himself, yeah, this might work. And after about an hour of this, they get down off of the rickshaw. And she throws her arms up and she says, wasn't that wonderful? And wasn't that rickshaw driver handsome? There's magic to love. Thank you.
Yes, well, I just assumed it.
When do you think you knew about it?
Oh, they generally take me 5 years.